This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 85 was recorded on October 19th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Petroleum geologist Art Berman has been one of our most popular guests ever on this program, and Art is back this week for our feature interview. As usual, Art prepared a fantastic book of charts and graphs for this interview, which you're not going to want to miss. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will cover my own outlook for the crude oil market, as well as a number of other topics. It'll be a long show today, but I think you're going to find the content well worthwhile. I'm also delighted to announce that we received our first $1,000 donation this week. Your donations really make a big difference, and as a direct result of this very generous donation and several other smaller donations that we received this week as well, we're now able to release the remainder of Eurodollar University much earlier than originally planned. You can expect Part 3 to be released this weekend as a supplemental show in addition to the regular Thursday program, and we'll be telling you more about our programming plans through the year end in our post-game segment after the feature interview.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 once again hit all-time new highs. And then this morning, we got a big downdraft in the market, but now the market has completely reversed. What's your take on the S&P 500? Where are we going here?
Yeah, it just never ceases to amaze me. The thing that blows my mind is the people that were freaking out over the 15 points down and the calls you were hearing. It's on. The crash of 17 is upon us. 15 points down, that's what, like 0.5%? And people are freaking out. Imagine when we really do get a crash starting. But I don't think it's now. Now, I don't have a crystal ball, but if I had to guess, I would say, look, it's late October. This October crash that so many people were predicting is not happening. What comes to mind, Patrick, is that old adage that the primary function of the stock market is to embarrass the maximum number of people possible. And if I had to guess what's going to happen next, I would say that we get through the autumn period without a crash. Then you get to the point where all of the people that warned about how this was going to be the big one are being publicly ridiculed. They're playing the old tapes back on CNBC and Bloomberg of, you know, Ray Dalio and other really smart people saying, watch out, we could be in for some real trouble. And they're being ridiculed. And it's causing this melt up where everybody is piling in. All the bulls are getting even more bullish. All the bears have been, quote unquote, proven wrong. There's millennials lined up around the corner waiting to open their E-Trade account, and we go at least to 3,000 on the S&P, and then we have the blow-off top, and it gets really, really ugly from there. Now, I could be wrong. That's a guess. Don't blame me if the market crashes sooner than that. But if I had to guess what happens, we don't have the degree of retail participation in this market, and frankly, we don't have the degree of really crazy euphoria that you usually see at the final top of a bull market. I think it's coming. I think we're very late in the story, but I don't think it's quite yet. It's definitely not time to be short yet. And as far as I'm concerned, the people who should be long in this market are only those who understand it's a bubble, who understand it's going to be a blow off. There's a lot of people who are smart enough to know how to trade that and seize both the upside and the downside. Personally, I'm happy to be on the sidelines.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index next, because to me, this is the most interesting story. I mean, we're still trading here right around the 93 level on the dollar index, and it's going to be very curious here whether or not this has been a real turnaround in the dollar, or if this was just a oversold bounce, and then it's going to re-resume its selling. What's your take on the dollar here?
Well, a lot of people have been talking about a formative inverse head and shoulders on the daily chart, which is not confirmed yet. It would have to close above 94, which is where the neckline is on that pattern, in order to confirm that pattern. That would be very bullish. I think what's been driving the strength in the dollar for the last week or so is the rumors about John Taylor being considered for Fed chair. And of course, Taylor is the originator of the so-called Taylor Rule, named after him. Now, Patrick, the Taylor Rule prescribes that that central banks should use a formula to determine what the Fed funds interest rate should be, rather than just doing it on a discretionary basis the way it's been done. That's caused a lot of people to speculate that if Taylor got in, his Taylor rule or some version of it might be implemented as a matter of policy. And of course, if you were to use his equation, and if you're not familiar with this, just go to Wikipedia and put in Taylor rule and you'll find an article all about it. If you were to apply that equation now, it would not be telling you the Fed funds rate should be at 1%. It would be telling you it should be much higher. So a lot of people think that John Taylor would bring higher interest rates and therefore a stronger dollar. President Trump has said now publicly that he will make his choice for Fed chair by the time that he leaves on an international trip. I believe that's November 2nd, 2 weeks from today. So when we get that nomination, we know who the president's pick for the next Fed chair is. That's going to be probably when the dollar makes a big move in one direction or the other.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil, because crude oil here retested its highs from September. And now we've seen a little bit of a reversal off there, trading just in the 51.5 area. What's your thinking here on crude?
Well, let's start out with inventory. Crude oil drew down 5.7 million barrels this week. That was after API had forecast more than a 7 million barrel drawdown. Cushing, Oklahoma, building about 0.2 million barrels. Gasoline, building 0.9 million barrels. Distillates, building 0.5 million barrels. So we've got finished products building across the board. Big crude drawdown, but not nearly as big as API forecast it to be. And the thing is, exports are back up in a big way. 12.6 million barrels of oil exported from the United States last week. So you could make the argument, hey, that 5.7 million barrel drawdown would have been a 6 million barrel build if it was still illegal to export crude oil. And finally, production dropped off a little bit this week. I'm going to do things a little bit differently this week, Patrick. Let's save the rest of my comments on the oil market until after the feature interview. I want our listeners to be informed by Art Berman's views first, and then I'm going to give my perspective after hearing the interview with Art myself and compare it to my own views. We'll do that in the postgame segment.
All right, well, let's move on to gold then. And the observation I have to make is that at least for now, it seems literally that gold is a reciprocal on the dollar. Almost every single day, almost to the T, we have either dollar up, which then gold is down, or we have the dollar down and then gold up. I don't know. I mean, we obviously, the correlation has always been there, but it seems to be really tracking itself here. I mean, what's your take on gold?
Well, we touched 1277 this week as the low on the week. Maybe that was the opportunity to take Jeff Christian's advice and buy gold here. The reason I didn't do that and the reason I'm still on the sidelines is exactly what you just said, Patrick, which is the dollar is clearly what is controlling the gold market here. This head and shoulders pattern that everybody's talking about, I think it's probably going to be not until the president makes his decision for Fed chair nomination, which he's supposed to do in the next couple of weeks. If we did see a completion of that head and shoulders, it would potentially be several points higher on the DX. That's got to move gold substantially lower. So I'm not ready to buy gold until I see what happens with the dollar, and particularly until I know what the president's choice is going to be with respect to the Fed chair.
All right, Eric, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yields, which are now hovering around the 231 level. In September, we obviously saw an uptick hit around 240, and since then, we've been pulling back. Do you think that the highs of the interest rates are in and we're heading lower, or what's your take on it?
Well, I talked to Juliet DeClercq this week. I'm looking forward to getting her, hopefully by the end of the year, back on the program. She is still long U.S. Treasuries here at 231. She expects lower yields. That's also what I'm expecting. I really don't have a firm view. You know, we're right in the middle of this trading range between 2 spot 12 and 2 spot 64, I think is the top end of the range. And I'm going to have to defer to someone like Juliet, who is a better authority than I am. Let's see if we can get her on the show in the next few weeks, and we'll go deeper into this subject, because for the last few weeks, I really don't have a strong opinion.
Before we move on to this week's featured interview, I'd like to let our listeners know that Eric was interviewed by our good friend Jesse Felder on the Felder Report podcast. There's a link to that interview with Eric on the other side of the microphone in your Research Roundup email, or you can just go to Jesse's website, thefelderreport.com/podcast, and you'll find the link. Eric, please give us our listeners a quick overview of what to expect in the interview.
You know, I love Jesse's style. He has a very different approach than I do. So it's not the usual stuff that we talk about on Macro Voices. When I have a guest on the program, I try to figure out what that guy knows about the market and bring out as much as I can. Jesse's style is to figure out the guy. So it was mostly about my background, you know, how I snuck into MIT as a teenager and how I got screwed over by private banking and what I did in the software business, how flying airplanes has changed the way that I think about trading, stuff like that. And we talked about all kinds of topics. One of them that actually surprised me, how much reaction we've gotten on Twitter. We talked a little bit about energy policy. I mentioned thorium reactors and said we could come back to it, and we never did get back to it. And now we're just being inundated on Twitter. So very briefly, just to appease those people who are asking for a follow-up about thorium reactors, I am very strongly of the opinion that what should happen, the right thing for the environment, the right thing for the planet, the responsible thing to do, is we very much need to embrace nuclear energy. Patrick, something most people have no idea about is the history of how it came to be that uranium-powered boiling water reactors are what the whole nuclear energy industry is based on. And the answer is fascinating to me. They had choices back when, you know, this industry was in its infancy of what kind of fuel to use. Uranium was only one of the possible choices. Well, how did they make that choice? At the time, this was the dawn of the Cold War. And a byproduct of a uranium reaction is that it creates the plutonium needed in order to make atomic weapons. The reason that they chose the uranium reactor in the first place is that it allowed the creation of plutonium needed for the nuclear weapons. And that made sense at the time. The thing is, way back then, like 60 years ago, they also experimented with a totally different process, which is called a liquid fluoride thorium reactor. Now, the guy who knows all about this, if you want to learn more about it, is called Kirk Sorensen, with S-E-N, not S-O-N. He's on Twitter. He's been interviewed on a bunch of podcasts. He's a very smart guy, NASA scientist. And he explains that basically the problem with nuclear reactors, the reason you have a Fukushima, is that that uranium reaction, it's producing a huge amount of heat, and you have to be able to continue to pump water to cool it. If the pumps fail, you get the so-called China syndrome, the meltdown, where, you know, there's just horrific consequences. And that's why there really is a lot of danger inherent to boiling water uranium reactors. Now, the liquid fluoride thorium reactor is a different process. You can just turn the thing off. There's no risk of what if the pumps fail. And that's what happened in Fukushima, was they were trying to harden the electrical facilities that would provide the electricity to run those pumps no matter what. There was an underground switching station which flooded with seawater after the tsunami hit, and that's the reason that they ended up with a meltdown situation and that horrible accident. That could never happen with a thorium reactor, and that's the reason that this Kirk Sorensen guy is just so hot wanting to build it. It is a huge investment, though. And the thing that people have to realize is, yes, there's good reason to be concerned about the safety of nuclear energy, but that is a concern that is specific to uranium reactors. The thorium reactor solves all of those safety problems, according to Sorensen. Now, I'm not a personal expert on nuclear energy technology. Sorensen sounds like a very credible guy to me. He tells a fascinating story. So if you want to learn more about it, I recommend you Google Kirk Sorensen. Just Google Kirk Sorensen. Patrick, back to you.
Well, thanks for the summary, Eric. Now, for this week's featured interview, we have petroleum geologist Art Berman that will be joining us. Eric's interview with Art Berman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is petroleum geologist Art Berman. Art prepared a fantastic slide deck to accompany this interview that you're definitely going to want to download, because we'll be referring to it throughout most of the interview. Registered users at macrovoices.com will find the download link in your research roundup email. If you're not registered yet, just go to macrovoices.com. On the homepage, right next to Art Berman's picture, look for a red button that says looking for the download and click on it. Art, thanks so much for joining us. Let's go ahead and start with your slide deck, starting on page number 2 here after your title slide. I just love your charts, the way that you are so visual in the way that you describe things. But go ahead and tell us what this chart is about on page 2.
All right, Eric. Well, thanks for the compliment on the charts, and it's great to be back with you. It's been a while, and always glad to talk to you. I talk a lot about comparative inventory, and I do it because I think it's really important. You don't hear a lot about it. You hear people, you know, sometimes reference the five-year average, et cetera, but to me, this is the main tool that cuts through most, if not all, of the confusion about why oil prices are doing what they're doing and where they might be going. So slide number 2, it's just a history of comparative inventory. Again, that's the current stock levels minus the five-year average. And in this case, I'm using crude plus a basket of refined petroleum products, which I think are the most diagnostic. So it's comparative inventory, or CI in blue, versus WTI spot price in gold. And what you can see looking at this thing is that there's an awfully good negative correlation between comparative inventory and WTI spot price, and that's the reason that it's important. The salient features on this chart are that back in mid-February, we were not at an all-time high comparative inventory, which is actually back in March, April of 2016, but we were pretty darn high. We were second highest, 213 million barrels by my count, and we have dropped as of yesterday to 74 million barrels. That is huge. That's a 139 million barrel drop over, you know, a period of 30 some odd weeks. And there have been a couple of weeks where, you know, it went up a little or went sideways, but that is consistent. That's a trend. We have to pay attention to it. What's also important and interesting is that typically we see a pretty big price response. Again, just looking at this time period since the price collapse in 14, see a pretty good price response whenever comparative inventory goes down. And it's really striking how we've had the biggest drop in comparative inventory ever, and prices have just kind of hung in there between, you know, really $45 and $55 a barrel. I'm showing 40 to 50, and so an astute observer would say, well, you know, your correlation doesn't really work. And I would argue that actually it does, that an awful lot of those price responses were based on sentiment. And they, you know, we had some price run-ups, particularly in early 16, that proved to be vapor and went away in a big hurry. So those are the key points in this. And as we get on to the next slide or two, I'll explain exactly why, in fact, prices is responding exactly as it should. It is it still is an awfully good negative correlation. It's just the amplitude has been suppressed as it should be.
Now, before we move on to the next slide, which is one of my favorite charts of all the ones that you do, I've got a question on this one, because I can't help but notice that this period that you have in the dark red rectangle here, where price appears not to be responding to rapidly declining comparative inventory, it's also roughly the same time period that exports have been legal. And some people have argued that with the legalized export of U.S. crude, basically the oil that was being put in storage before is now being exported. If you were to adjust your comparative inventory to say, let's pretend all exported oil got added to inventory, then it would be a vastly different picture. So do you think that there's any truth to that? And how do you reconcile that? Because we're really kind of apples to oranges when we talk about comparative inventory. It's based on a five-year average. Well, for all of those 5 years, it was illegal to export crude oil from the United States during that period. So does that change your view at all?
No, it really doesn't. I mean, your point is well taken, and we do need to talk about it. But the theory and the practical application of comparative inventory, I mean, this was all developed by Mike Bodell, who is a dear friend and colleague of mine. He put it together when he was at UNICAL back in the early 2000s, has done a couple of proprietary publications, but really hasn't put a lot out there in the public domain. So first of all, let me give credit to Mike. I didn't invent this. It took me a long time to, to really catch on to why it was so important. But, you know, more importantly, it really doesn't matter where the, you know, where the inventories go. The point is that price is responsive to inventory levels. And whether inventories are being reduced because of crude oil exports, which is the basis of your question, or whether they're being reduced because of increased consumption in the United States or whatever, or lower crude oil production, whatever the reason, the fundamental precept is that price responds to inventory. Because, and this is so important, Eric, that we think in terms of supply and demand, okay? And that's the way it should be. But inventory is part of both. It's part of supply because it's available. And the whole idea of inventory is, well, when you don't have enough field production to meet demand, where do you get it from? Well, it's like your savings account. I don't have enough money to pay, you know, this major medical bill this month. How am I going to pay for it? Well, I could put it on a credit card, I suppose, but the wise way to do it is say, well, I'll take some money out of savings. That's what inventory is. Inventory is your savings. So my view on supply and demand and all these discussions of market balance is you better tell me how inventory is responding to both supply and demand, because if you're not talking about inventory, then I don't know what you're talking about. You're talking about production and consumption, which is different than supply and demand. Demand and supply involve the buffer of inventory between production and consumption. So bottom line, Eric, is I don't think it makes a difference. It's a great question and one that I'm sure is on a lot of people's minds, but to me, it doesn't matter.
Let's go ahead and move on to slide 3 then, because this is one of my favorites. You're basically animating or showing us the historic picture of where comparative inventory has been in the past and where it's going and what it means with respect to price. And I guess before we move off from that last slide, I should mention too, we have in past interviews when you've been on the show gone into much more detail about the theory of comparative inventory and why it's so important. So if anybody's looking for more depth on that, go back and listen to prior interviews. Let's go ahead now to slide 3. Talk us through this, how the yield curve works and what it predicts.
Sure. So the yield curve is the black line. It's the fit through all of those data points. The data points are a simple cross plot of comparative inventory on the x-axis and WTI spot price on the y-axis. And it's important to show the previous slide and this slide because the previous slide includes time. And while this does, there's no axis that shows it. So, and I've connected the dots. You can see there's a light blue line. And if you're good at, or your eyesight's better than mine, you can probably see the time progression, and unless the data points get real tight. But so the logic here and the behind the yield curve is the y-axis is the 5-year average. So where that yield curve intersects the y average, or the y axis, is where price should be when we're at the 5-year average, obviously. And that's what Bodell calls the mid cycle price. The mid cycle price is what it says. It's the median value of all the price versus comparative inventory cross plots over the life of this particular cycle. Now, a lot of people will look at that fit and they'll say, gee, it's not a perfect regression fit. And that's absolutely right, because there's a lot of points, and I'm showing the March through June 2015 unwarranted optimism, the effect of the OPEC production cut, optimism. Those are elevated values that are based on sentiment and are not based on the actual cross-plotted data. So fair enough, you know, there's an interpretation that goes into where to put that yield curve. It's not a mathematically defined regression, although you'll see that it does match, you know, an awful lot of those points quite well. So the bottom line, Eric, is that every week, you can see I've got October 13th which was the data that came out yesterday, in yellow. There's a blue dot just to its right. That was October 6th, the previous storage report. And you can see that we're moving toward the y-axis. We're reducing comparative inventory, and the yield curve is climbing, which means that the price should be somewhat higher because of that large move in comparative inventory. The important thing here, and the reason that we haven't seen a lot of price response, is we got so much oil stored up in inventory that the yield curve has been incredibly flat up until just very recently, like the last couple of weeks. And so the yield curve predicts that price shouldn't change very much because you still got so much storage to work through before you even begin approaching the five-year average. Now we're getting into an area of the graph where the curvature or the inflection of that yield curve is starting to increase. What that means is that if we continue drawing down inventory and comparative inventory as we have for the last 30-some-odd weeks, we're now going to start seeing a more pronounced price response with every incremental reduction in comparative inventory. So this is a very simple thing. You tell me what you think comparative inventory will be by the end of this year or by the first quarter of next year, a value, read up to the yield curve and then read across to the y-axis, and that's what the yield curve predicts that the WTI spot price should be. So based on all of this and the rate that we're drawing down inventory, I'm saying, you know, by the end of this year, we should be certainly above $55, and by sometime in the first quarter of 2018, again, assuming that this trend continues, $60 wouldn't shock me at all.
Well, I think it's important to point out, too, there's almost a double bullish argument here. One, as you said, is that we're at this inflection point where the curve gets steeper. So the same amount of draw on inventory causes more price response in this section of the curve. The other part of this that you didn't mention yet is that what a lot of people are predicting is that this trend around exports is going to increase. So if we take at face value what you said earlier, which is it doesn't matter if it went to export or consumption or where it went, there's a good argument that this growth in exports is going to cause the rate of draw in inventory to accelerate from here. And that could really move us very quickly to higher prices, according to what you're showing here. Is that right?
That's right. Now, there are two important disclaimers that I'm going to put in there. The first one is, let's understand what the nature of the composition of U.S. crude oil is compared to the world norm. We are producing a whole lot of super light oil, okay? The world norm and what most refineries need is a whole lot heavier than what we're producing. So, you know, we talk about something called API gravity, which is just a variant on specific gravity. So the average refinery in the world, including the U.S., likes to have about 30 API gravity. The average tight oil that's produced in the U.S. is like about 45 to 50 API gravity, so it's a whole lot lighter. That presents a problem because global refineries are not engineered. They can't just put 40 API gravity into a refinery. They have to blend it with much heavier oil, like 20, you know, like from Canada's oil sands or, you know, Mexican Mayan crude. They got to blend it with heavier oil to get it to equal what the refinery is capable of taking. So that's kind of technical, but it's kind of important because the whole reason we're exporting oil is because we can't refine it all. And you might say, well, gee, you know, why don't we just fix the refineries so that they can take it? Well, that's a real expensive fix. And refineries, those are long-term investments. So first of all, you got to believe or you got to convince the refiners that there's going to be enough supply of this ultralight oil from tight oil reservoirs to last 30 years or whatever the life cycle of that investment is. So that's number one. The U.S. and the world doesn't have infinite capacity to refine ultralight oil from the United States. And global capacity, while the absolute number of barrels per day is higher, as a percent, it's no greater than the U.S. So there are limits to how much U.S. ultralight oil can be, that there's even demand for in the world. And an awful lot of the reason that we're able to export as much as we can right now is because other sources of light oil, like Nigeria, have been going through all kinds of outages and disruptions. So we're basically taking refinery space from Bonny Light from Nigeria. But otherwise, we're going to have to compete. And the only way to get it in to limited refinery capacity is to take a big discount. Second disclaimer is that, okay, this is great. We're reducing U.S. comparative inventory by exporting a whole bunch overseas, but in a world that's oversupplied with oil, there are limits to that. The world can't just continue to absorb as much oil as the United States wants to send it unless its supply is also going down or its demand is also going up. So it's not a black hole that you can just throw as much oil into as you like. And so until this overall oversupply phenomenon that we've been dealing with since 2014 is cured, and we're not there yet by a long shot, you can't just put as much oil out there as you want. Eventually, the world is going to say, enough. You're just compounding our own problems with oversupply.
Let's go ahead and move on to slide 4, where you're showing us both the background is the oil price shown in gray there, and then we have inventories as well as the 5-year history. Talk us through this chart.
Right. So again, here we're showing absolute inventory in gold, 5-year average in blue, so you can imagine that the comparative inventory is, you know, somewhere in between. And this really, gosh, I mean, if you want to understand why oil prices collapsed in 2014, this graph says it all. It's because we were producing so much oil that we just started putting it all into storage. We couldn't use it. And so that, you know, that gigantic buildup in inventories between early 2015 and sometime about a year later is a perfect negative correlation to the oil price collapse. We just were producing too much oil, and then the price got down so low that it wasn't worth selling it. It was cheaper to put it into storage. So to me, this graph explains exactly how we got to where we are with low oil prices and how we're going to get out of it. Now, I'm showing that there was a 213 million barrel gap between inventory levels and the 5-year average earlier this year, and that's way down to 74. But historically, 74 is still huge. I mean, I'm showing back in, you know, 2010 on the left-hand side of the graph, you know, one of the biggest discrepancies or gaps was 99 million barrels. So we've dropped a little bit below that, but I don't want to trivialize the fact that we still got a pretty big distance to go before we actually get to the 5-year average. Making good progress, but I don't want people to, you know, start popping champagne bottles if they think that higher oil prices are good. Not everybody does, by the way. We still got some distance to go. We're making good progress. That's the essence of this graph.
And the next slide 5, we're looking at refinery intakes. Talk us through this one.
So refinery intakes, which are shown in green on here, have been at record levels for most of 2017. We've been above 17 million barrels of oil per day. That's crude oil going into refineries, cranking out all kinds of refined products on the other side, which is way above levels that we've been at any time recently. What's going on? Well, the markets are there for those refined products, both at home and overseas. And so the way you make money on oil, unless you're a tight oil company that's kind of locked into commodity prices, is you refine it into something that has more value. You know, that was the whole idea behind Exxon and Chevron, you know, the majors. It wasn't the product itself that was so valuable. It was the gasoline, the jet fuel, the diesel, all the things. I mean, you add value to a relatively cheap commodity by refining it. So what we're seeing here is that refinery levels were super high, and then they dropped way off. And that was the combined effect mostly of Hurricane Harvey but also the subsequent hurricanes that hit Florida and Puerto Rico and whatever. So that shut down an awful lot of refineries. Some of them were flooded. They had to do a bunch of maintenance. It also disrupted a lot of pipelines that deliver oil both to and take products from those refineries. And what you see on this graph is that we haven't recovered yet from those hurricane disruptions. In fact, this week, refinery intakes took another drop down, and that's important. We also see a huge drop this last week, this last data point, in production of crude oil. That's because of Hurricane Nate. Now, you know, Nate didn't turn out to be a horribly destructive hurricane onshore in the U.S., but it shut down tremendous amount of offshore oil production. So we're seeing really from September onward, a lot of this graph is showing you the effect on refineries and distribution infrastructure of hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic Ocean. So pretty powerful stuff. The Nate thing is temporary. We were recovering from before Nate, and you know, in another couple of weeks, we should be back to 17 million a day or whatever the norm was earlier.
Now, the thing that strikes me about the area that you have inside the red oval here, it's also refinery maintenance season when most refineries go into partial shutdown in order to retool their equipment to produce winter grades of gasoline. So would that explain it? Could it be because of refinery maintenance that we're seeing this incomplete recovery, and as soon as turnarounds are done, we're going to go back up to where the previous norm was, or do you think there's more to it than that?
No, that's part of it, certainly. But the spikiness, the big weekly drops, I think, are certainly the big drop in refinery intakes. That was clearly hurricane. That was before the maintenance. So maintenance is a factor. But again, back to comparative inventory, part of the reason comparative inventory is so powerful is that you're comparing something with the same time period in previous years. And so if refinery maintenance is an issue, it was also an issue a year ago and over the last 5 years. So the fact that we're continuing to drop comparative inventory despite refinery maintenance is saying that we are moving through more inventory during this refinery maintenance season than we did last year and over the past 5 years. Comparative inventory, it normalizes all that stuff out, whereas just inventories alone might lead you to say, oh gosh, you know, inventories went down a whole lot. Well, yeah, they always do, or so. Fair point, Eric, it's part of it, but I still think the major effect that we're looking at here is weather.
To summarize, it's really already baked into the chart because comparative inventory, as you say, is reflective of previous refinery maintenance seasons. Let's go ahead and move on to slide 6. What's this one telling us about?
Well, again, this is showing two things. It's showing comparative inventory again, the reference point, but now it's showing domestic consumption of everything that comes out of our refineries. And I got two curves here. The weekly variation, which is great, is kind of a little transparent because that's distracting. And then the darker blue is the four-week average, which is really the important thing to take a look at. And so what we see here is that U.S. consumption of refined products has increased, and that's a big source of the drop in comparative inventory. And so we're talking about, in fact, consumption reached an all-time high over the summer compared to other summers when we had a lot of car driving and vehicle miles traveled and all of that. So this is real important. It's saying that big source, or one of the big of two sources of inventory drawdown here, is demand, domestic demand. Why is domestic demand up? Well, you know, that's a question for economists, but part of it has to be that the U.S. economy, at least superficially, seems stronger and is responding to lower oil prices, lower gasoline prices, lower refined product prices. People are buying more of it. So even though I'm a little bit skeptical about the health of the U.S. and the global economy, you can't ignore or deny what the data is telling you, particularly when it's a trend. If it's, you know, a couple of weeks, well, maybe it'll change. But consumption in the U.S. for refined products is way up, and that's an important factor in inventory reduction. So if we go on and look at a related graph, which is slide number 7, here I'm showing a related graph. Here I'm showing net imports, okay? So it's exports of refined products minus imports. Obviously, if we're making more of our own product at home than in consuming more, then our net imports are going to drop. And that's what this is showing. This is showing that we, in fact, and I'm quantifying it, that our decrease in refined products this year compared to last is almost 500,000 barrels a day. You take 500,000 barrels a day and you multiply by 7 days of the week, which is how we measure inventories or stocks, and you end up with almost 3.5 million barrels a week of added demand on inventory that didn't exist last year. So you can account for almost all of the comparative inventory reduction just by increased domestic consumption and demand of refined products, reflected here again through net imports. So that's a pretty big deal. And the other piece of the big deal, of course, is the exports, which you brought up, and that's slide number 8. And so here I'm showing both crude oil exports and net crude imports. Okay, so net crude import, which you import minus what you export, is another measurement of exactly the same thing we're talking about. So the exports, which are shown in blue, same scheme as before, the weekly data is a little bit subdued and the four-week average is shown a little bit more boldly, but our average level of crude oil exports this year are 320 or so thousand barrels a day, more than they were last year. Multiply by 7 and you get to 2.2 million barrels a week of increased exports, stuff going out of the country, therefore potentially reducing inventory. So these are the two biggies. Now, you know, you look at the last 3 weeks of exports. We exported almost 2 million barrels a day of oil 3 weeks ago. That's a record. Since we've been keeping records of this stuff, we've never exported, I think maybe during the Gulf of Suez crisis, whenever that was in the late 50s or early 60s, I don't remember. We might have come close to that, but you know, that was a blip, an anomaly. 2 weeks ago, we exported 1.3 million, which was huge. This past week, 1.8 million. Now, I don't expect those trends to stay at that level, but again, we're 3 data points doesn't make a trend, so we'll keep watching it. But this is a big deal. I mean, based on the annual average, we're exporting, you know, almost twice as much as a year ago. That is a trend. And these last 3 data points, wow, I guess our producers and refiners are figuring out how to make cracks in global market share. And this gets really important when we start talking about OPEC and what are they trying to accomplish. I mean, if the U.S. becomes, is able to erode market share by Saudi Arabia or other OPEC countries in, you know, Asia, Europe, that's a threat. And I've been a proponent for a long time of saying, you know, I don't think the Saudis are at war with shale producers. I think that there are other factors there. But if because of all this, now we're getting into their, you know, their home territory in Europe and Asia, well, you know, maybe now that becomes more of a factor.
I want to make sure that we point out for our listeners, too, when you're talking about 1.9 million barrels, 1.8 million barrels in exports, those are per day figures. So if we want to compare them to the weekly draw and build numbers that we hear in EIA, we need to multiply by 7. So 1.8 million barrels exported this week, that's really 12.6 million barrels multiplying by 7 to get the amount of oil. So if you look at the drawdown that we saw in inventory this week, it would have been a massive build in the opposite direction if that oil had not been exported. Now, of course, we can't make that assumption, because if that oil was not being exported, it probably would change the amount that was being imported. So it's impossible to really know what the impacts of this are. The other thing I wanted to point out is just my reaction hearing you talk about this demand story. There's a narrative that you hear so much of these days, not my view at all, but you'll hear a lot of people say, look, the story for oil is over. Electric vehicles are the way of the future. They're already cutting into demand in a big way. That's going to continue. Demand is falling off a cliff, baby. It's electric vehicles all the way. You don't need oil anymore. Well, gee, if that's true, it's not showing up in the data, is it?
No, you know, don't get me wrong. I'm just, because I happen to be in the oil and gas business, you know, I'm also a citizen of planet Earth, and you know, I think renewable energy is the direction we need to be going in, is clearly part of the long-term solution. We can debate the details and the costs, and there are problems with that. But you're absolutely right, Eric. There is just no evidence that I see that demand for oil is showing any effect whatsoever of electric vehicles and, you know, and renewable energy. And of course, if you actually look at what percentage of primary energy consumption those sources are, I mean, they're almost too small to measure. You know, in the United States, I think wind plus solar, you know, is something like 2 or 2.5% of total primary energy consumption. So don't get me wrong, it's growing. It's going to have to grow an awful lot more before it becomes a factor that is important. Oil, natural gas, coal, they power the world right now. I agree that the long-term trend is going to be more towards renewables, less towards fossil fuel. But I think we're talking, I'd be shocked if we saw any measurable decrease in oil demand in the next 10 years, honestly. So I think people are getting a little ahead of themselves there. They're looking at annual rates of increase, which are high, but they're not looking at what the impact is on total. So, you know, I mean, whenever I go and talk to university students, they say, oh, but, you know, electric vehicles, they're going to displace oil demand. And I ask, you know, it might be a couple of hundred people in the auditorium, how many people here drove to this meeting? And everybody raises their hand. How many drove an electric vehicle? And usually almost nobody raises their hand. So, well, there's my point. You know, it doesn't reflect a bias. It's just a fact. You know, we got a couple of hundred young people that are all very much in favor of renewable energy, and all you guys drove yourselves, and you drove in gasoline or diesel-powered cars. So when I start seeing that demographic, then we'll pay attention.
Speaking of gasoline and diesel-powered cars, moving on to slide 9, you've got distillate and gasoline inventories. And we should explain for our listeners who may not be familiar, distillates is a code word in the industry that means diesel fuel, jet fuel, and a number of other things, kerosene and so forth, that are all very similar in their chemical composition. What's going on particularly with distillates? I've been reading a lot about this. I mean, I understand there was a hurricane and everything, but wow, look at just how huge that drawdown has been. Is there a problem with the ability to make more, or what's going on?
Not that I'm aware of, and I you know, I'm a geologist, not a chemical engineer, but my sense is that demand for diesel is huge, both in the U.S. and in the world. So some of what you're seeing here, and you know, I'm showing the green box, some of what you're seeing here is that during hurricane disruption of refineries, and you know, we went from more than 17 million barrels a day down to about 13 million barrels a day. So big drop, almost a quarter of refinery capacity went offline because of the hurricanes. Well, there's still demand for diesel distillate in the world. So how are we going to get it to sell to all those hungry people ready to write checks or use their credit cards? Draw it out of inventory. So, you know, in a way, it's kind of a win-win, because our refineries are down, we're not producing as much, but as a result, we're drawing inventories down hugely because we want to make money, we want to sell the stuff. Gasoline, you know, tends to be more seasonal, and you can see that in the graph that the driving season is over in the United States. So gasoline inventories, or CI in this case, comparative inventories, are they always go up. But and distillate, you know, went up a little bit this week. But distillate is a big component of the growth in our exports. The other one, interestingly, is liquids, natural gas liquid, liquefied petroleum gases, liquefied refinery gases. Those are the two huge components of export growth. And, you know, those gases, or the liquefied form of those gases, and diesel. So that's what this thing's showing.
And moving on to slide 10, a subject very near and dear to my heart, which is I've just been amazed at how quickly backwardation has been developing in the term structure. What is this slide telling us on slide 10?
You're the expert on this, Eric, and you've taught me a lot of what I know about term structure. But to me, this is saying that the term structure of WTI, and I'm not showing Brent, but it shows, you know, something similar, is reflecting the tightening of supply that I've been discussing and describing through the mechanism of comparative inventory reduction. Now, there are many other things going on here, but as you start working through this big overhang of storage, then that says you got, you know, less in your savings account if you have a big expense, and that moves the forward curve forward to say, you know, don't store, sell. And the price is higher in the very near term and the prompt couple of months than the market at least thinks it's going to be 6 months, 12 months, 18 months out in the future. Does that kind of reflect your view, Eric?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, the thing that is really speaks to me, the fact that, you know, in this case, we've moved from September 5th, $47 and change for front month oil, all the way up to $52 as we're speaking this week. Okay, that doesn't surprise me too much. There are probably a number of reasons beyond that. But the fact that in the very same time period that we went up by $5, the long dated contracts out in December of 22 have gone down by $5 in the very same period. And the thing that that really says to me is producer hedging is very actively happening, that you've got producers hedging their forward production 2 years out or so, and that that's causing a lot of selling further out in the curve. And that to me is the explanation. We don't see it on this particular graph, but these curves all do curve up a little bit more of a steep upward slope back into contango as you move beyond 22 out towards 23, 24, 25. So I think that it's really about 2 years out where the producer hedging is putting the downward pressure on this, while at the same time we've got upward pressure on the front month. Let's move on to slide 11 now, where we're looking at OPEC and non-OPEC production cuts. And, you know, this is something that has confounded me. The market just reacts so strongly to what they say they're going to do as opposed to what they're actually doing. What are you showing us here on slide 11?
Yeah, slide 11 is basically showing the magnitude of those OPEC and, you know, Russia plus Mexico and, you know, a couple other minor players, liquids production compared with when the cuts were announced in November. And what you see is that early on, like in, you know, March, April, I mean, they'd actually removed more from the market than their target of 1.8 million a day. But in more recent months, the compliance hasn't been as tight. So really the point of this graph, and I don't want to dwell on it, is just to say the OPEC cuts matter. Taking a million barrels a day off the market matters. Is it absolutely the prime or the only mover in the market? No, they're just not capable, apparently, of complying with their own regulations or their own agreed upon production cuts for more than a couple of months. That's the point of this graph.
The next one, slide 12, really fascinates me because it doesn't surprise me at all to see this deficit that you're showing through 2017, because that's what the whole front of your presentation was about. But you, I thought, were saying earlier on that you expected the drawdowns to continue and that we would maybe be moving up in price going into 2018, but it looks like there's a supply surplus shown on this graph. So is that at odds with what you said earlier?
I don't think so, Eric. Keep in mind that this includes forecast, obviously. I mean, I'm showing, you know, out through the end of 2018. And so everything up through really Q3, third quarter of 17, is data. So So I'm using an amalgamation here of EIA consumption, IEA demand, and OPEC demand plus some BP. So you won't see a graph like this from too many other sources. And so obviously there's some, you know, algorithms, formulas that I've used to get between, you know, all of these different sources. But 2018 is a forecast by everybody. The character of this whole graph has changed over time as this comparative inventory drawdown becomes more and more apparent. So moving into 2018, first point, those surpluses are not that great. Okay, you know, we're talking about, you know, say average of 500,000 barrels a day. Compare that to where we were, you know, a year, year and a half ago, where we were 2 million barrels a day oversupplied. Supply versus demand. So is market balance the panacea? No, it doesn't turn out to be. Getting close to market balance is helpful. But so I suspect that if this demand and therefore comparative inventory trend continues, that these forecasts will change. But even if they don't, 500,000 barrels a day of global liquid surplus, that's not an alarm bell for me. So to me, the important thing is the data. The forecasts are what they are, and I'm not going to dispute or argue with them. But I like to live in the present, and the present tells me we're moving in the direction of higher prices.
And definitely confirmation, BNP Paribas just came out this morning saying 500,000 barrels per day of surplus through 2018, very much matching with what you show on this graph. Let's move on to your final slide, number 13, because, boy, this is a subject that has really just been preoccupying my brain. You know, it's very easy to see why after the hurricanes or in the immediate wake of Hurricane Harvey, of course, you had a whole bunch of U.S. refinery shut-ins, and that meant less demand for U.S. crude oil, more demand overseas because we had to buy finished product to deal with the fact that we were taken offline. Makes perfect sense that that Brent WTI spread blew out as dramatically as it did right after the hurricane. But I am just confounded, Art, to understand why as U.S. refining capacity has come fully back online, that spread continues to widen. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, the average of the spread for most of for all of 2017 has been about $1.50. That's kind of where it's been for a long time. And so the spread started to widen. The premium on Brent started way before the hurricanes, started back end of June, early July. The Harvey didn't hit until late August. So something else is going on here. And the two something else's that I'm showing on this graph in blue is that Brent WTI spread. And I'm showing some current events. And so we've had this thing going on in the background where Qatar has been at odds with its Persian Gulf neighbors, largely Saudi Arabia, over its affinity to Iran and some of the Shiites. And, you know, they paid some ransom back in early June to get some of their hostages freed. Qatar restored diplomatic relations with Iran right about the time Hurricane Harvey hit the U.S. And then the Kurds in Iraq voted for independence in late September. And so I think some of this has got to do with a fear premium, you know, market concern about supply mostly of Brent based on Persian Gulf, Middle Eastern tensions. But the other thing that's fascinating and confusing to me is I'm showing in orange or gold Cushing comparative inventory. So this whole discussion we've been talking about how U.S. comparative inventory is going down, but look at what's been happening at Cushing. It's been going in the opposite direction. It's been building. And of course, when Cushing get close to 80% of capacity, and we're pretty close to that right now, you know, mid-70s, I think, that always affects WTI to the negative. And again, that started way before the hurricanes hit. I don't really have a good explanation for why Cushing inventories are building. Maybe you do, Eric. I can punt and say it's got something to do maybe with the fact that Cushing is landlocked versus the coastal sources or near coastal sources can ship oil in other ways. Landlocked refineries have only a certain amount of capacity for light oil. I don't really know, but I think the point is that spread is reducing. The last 2 weeks it's gone down. I expect it is going to go back to, you know, something closer to where it was the rest of the year. But I'm with you. I mean, there are aspects of this that I just can't explain.
Well, that definitely makes two of us on that one. Let's move on. Again, fantastic slide deck, Art. I love the work that you do with all of your slides and your blog and so forth. Let's get a couple questions in that we didn't get in the slide deck. Aramco and the IPO, a lot of people have really felt that one of the things that was certain to support oil prices going into 2018 is they just figure Saudi Arabia is going to do whatever it takes in order to keep prices up, leading up to the IPO of Saudi Aramco. Now, there are a lot of people have been skeptics for a long time about whether that deal was ever really going to happen. But now we've seen, you know, a lot of news coming out, leaks coming out saying that they've actually instructed the consultant that was working on investor relations to cease work because they may pursue a private placement where they don't have to be as transparent about their accounting as they would have been in a public transaction. And this, to me, it introduces this whole, I call it the China syndrome. You know, what happens where China is now apparently in direct negotiation with Saudi Arabia to buy a piece of Saudi Aramco? What happens if they make a deal behind closed doors and say, you know, we're going to buy as much oil as you want to sell us and you can store it in Saudi Arabia so that you don't have to export it and, you know, we'll send our Chinese military over to guard it secretly. But you can lie now and tell the world you're not exporting as much oil and, you know, it's true. You're not exporting as much oil. You're still selling as much oil. You're just storing it for us as well because we haven't built as much SPR capacity as we would like to in China. I mean, I can, and that's just one thought. So what do you think in general about the Aramco IPO? Is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? And what are the various knock-on effects that you think about?
I sure agree with some of your suspicions, Eric. This has got a lot to do with China. I was always skeptical. You know, the accounting is one thing, but reserve disclosure is another. I mean, we have had, the world has had grave doubts about Saudi, but OPEC approved reserve numbers forever. I mean, we just don't, you know, there's no independent audit. There's no way to know. And to think that Saudi Arabia in particular would be willing to open its books and actually show what it thinks its true reserves are for a relatively small percentage of Saudi Aramco IPO is just, I said, you know, they're not going to do that. I mean, well, again, if they had all those reserves, maybe they wouldn't care, but I don't think they do either. So to me, it's always been a suspicious deal, just another thing to throw out there into the mix that maybe causes oil prices to go up. But so I couldn't imagine that they would ever want to actually show what they think reserves are. But I think this gets to a bigger issue, and that is that the United States has moved away from, I think, regarding Saudi Arabia as crucial to our oil supply with the boom in tight oil or shale oil or whatever you want to call it. I think that's a hugely misguided perception. But basically, Saudi Arabia, by their actions, has shown we don't think the United States is that great of an ally anymore, okay? Certainly under Obama, Trump has made them feel better about at least his personal attention. But Saudi Arabia is having to go it alone in Yemen, and Obama made a deal with Iran against the, you know, all the best instincts of Saudi Arabia. And they're saying, boy, you know, maybe we need a better ally. And China's coming over and saying, well, you know, we'd like to be that ally because, after all, we buy a heck of a lot of your crude oil in Asia. So to me, it's an alliance that makes a lot of sense for both China and for Saudi Arabia. I think it works very much against U.S. interests, but this is the direction that our foreign policy has been taking for the last almost 9 years now. The bottom line for me, aside from reserve disclosure, I just think that Saudi Arabia is saying, hey, you know, we think oil prices are going to recover on their own. Now, you know, how much collusion is going on? We've talked about that before, Saudi manipulating the market. But, you know, I've been showing you data that says I think higher prices are coming. If higher prices are coming, then, you know, maybe we want to rethink this IPO anyway. Maybe we don't need it as much.
Final question. I want to move on to the longer term, you know, something I know you and I agree on. Whether or not you're right about a higher price is coming right now or not, you know, yet to be seen in the data. But someday, the shale revolution is going to play out. And I think a lot of people in finance who don't understand what you understand about how these things work, and particularly the depletion rates of shale wells, they think that shale just solves everything forever. Someday shale plays out. I saw a news story this week about Transocean scrapping rigs. They're not building any new ones. We're not ready to go back to deep water oil exploration and development because the equipment for doing that is basically rusting and being scrapped. It seems to me at some point we hit this inflection point where all of a sudden shale's played out. You need to go back to deep water offshore and you don't have the ability to do it and you get a real big spike in prices. I can't figure out when though. What are your thoughts on that?
Right. Well, nobody knows, and I would have probably put it out there in, you know, maybe 2022 or, you know, 23 or 21 if we'd had this conversation 4 or 5 months ago. You know, now with the trending downward, and I didn't show OECD comparative inventory, but it shows a similar thing as WTI. You know, went down quite a bit just last month. They only report monthly. But so all that does is, to me, it moves up the drop-dead date for, you know, for when all the underinvestment in both exploration, field development, rig maintenance, and production, it all comes crashing down and causes a price spike. It's purely speculative, and I hope everybody understands that, but you know, wouldn't surprise me if we start to see prices building towards, you know, levels that we said were impossible a couple of years ago, like $100 in 2019. You know, to me, it's just inevitable. There are all sorts of opinions out there to the contrary, and, you know, I'll refer you to, you know, Citi Research did a couple of pieces in August about how, you know, even without shale, we got plenty of oil for the 2020s. But, you know, on the other side, you know, gosh, we got the CEO of Schlumberger who's real worried about this. The top people in OPEC and Aramco, they've got some ulterior motives. But I think the smart people in the world are definitely worried about this. And a few propeller heads and investment banks, you know, want to tell you otherwise. Well, their motives aren't pure either. They're talking their book. I mean, they always are. So to me, it's always been a factor. I can't imagine how we could avoid a price spike. I wish we could. And I'm saying that it wouldn't shock me if we start to see a build up towards that, you know, in a year or so. Doesn't mean we're going to be there, but the trend that we're on right now is supply is getting tighter, and unless that changes in a hurry, then we eventually reach, you know, we reach the 5-year average sooner than later. Prices, because of the inflection in that yield curve, have already by then gotten to $70. Unless something happens in the world, why wouldn't they go to 100 or higher? Just because we're not prepared. We've had this lower for longer mantra going on for so long, we actually believe it. So I'm with you, Eric. It's out there. I think it's sooner than I would have thought 6 months ago.
Well, Art, we're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. I can't thank you again for another fantastic interview. I want to really make sure our listeners hear this one, though. Art's blog is free. All of the fantastic charts that you see in this particular download are typical of what you'll find in Art's free blog posts. Be sure, it is just crazy not to sign up at artberman.com for a free subscription to Art's blog. So I certainly read it with great interest every time it comes out, and I recommend it highly. Art, thank you so much. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Art Berman. I loved his comments about the decreasing levels of comparative oil inventory and how it could be shifting the price of oil in the new year. Now, what's your own take on the oil market outlook over the short term, medium term, long term? And especially now that you've heard Art's comments, what's your thinking?
Well, clearly, the question you have to ask yourself is, how is it possible that a guy like Art Berman, frankly, who has an impeccable record in terms of the calls that he's made in the past, how can he be so bullish in the very same week when the CEO of Vitol, which is the world's largest oil trader, said that he expects Brent prices to move down like $15 or $14 down to about $45 on average in 2018. And BNP Paribas also this week announced that they forecast global crude stocks to build 500,000 barrels per day through 2018. Well, I think the single most important issue to get your head around in the oil market is going to answer that question. I'm not sure what the answer is, but I can tell you what the question is. The question is, if we used to have a system where it was illegal to import, the question is, in the old system, it was illegal to export U.S. crude oil. And we've got a whole industry that focuses on EIA reports as a primary indicator of what the market direction should be. If we now have drawdowns on inventory, but at the same time, very large exports, do you basically say, well, but what would it would have been if that oil didn't get exported? Or do you take the view that Art expressed? And that's the reason I asked him that question, I think, on the very first slide, is, you know, if the oil's gone, according to Art, it's gone. That's it. Doesn't matter whether why it got moved or why it went someplace else. It's out of inventory. My take's a little different. It might be out of U.S. inventory, but I think what really matters is global inventory. If that oil is still piling up in storage, but the storage is someplace else that's outside the view of the EIA system, I think it's still a build. The thing is, at the same time, Art is definitely right that what people pay attention to is the U.S. inventory reports. So this is a really big question of how do you interpret this data now that it's not apples to apples. It's apples to oranges, because in the old system, you couldn't export oil. Now you can. It changes things. So what's the model? How do you adjust your interpretation of the data? I don't know the right answer, but I think that is the single most important question to ask yourself about today's oil market. I was really taken, though, Patrick, by Art's term structure chart. That was page 10 in his chart book. So I wanted to go deeper on this, but I wanted to check my own thinking before commenting on it in today's show. So after the interview with Art, I called Pat Hemsworth. Now, Pat is a commercial broker. She trades crude oil, but she's not one of these guys on a podcast like me who speaks authoritatively and confidently about what the hedgers are doing. She's the person who's actually putting the trades on behalf of the hedgers. She knows what's going on in that market. And I said, Pat, listen, I know the theory of how supposedly backwardation developing indicates a tightening of supply, blah, 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 blah. I know about the theory. I'd like your feedback on this question. I don't think it's about the theory. I think this is simpler than that. I think the reason that the back prices are so depressed is because hedgers are selling the crap out of the long-dated contracts so that they can get their financing to drill more shale wells in the United States. And Pat told me emphatically, 1,000%, that's exactly right. What this is about is the hedgers. And remember, she's the trader who's putting the trades on behalf of the hedgers. She said something else I hadn't really thought about. She said the reason that you see the open interest much closer to the front end of the curve than it used to be is that the dynamics of shale wells are much different than conventional oil wells. They used to lay hedges on all the way out. That's the reason crude oil futures trade 8 years out, is so that they could lay hedges on 7-8 years in the future. They really don't do that anymore, as you can see from the open interest in those long-dated futures contracts. It's more like 2 years out, and that's precisely the reason, according to Pat, that the 2020 December contract is the bottom of the term structure right now. So she told me very clearly, Patrick, that this is all about the hedging, and she pointed out also that one of the big players is Pemex. They are transparent about what they're doing. Pemex, of course, is the national oil company in Mexico. They just finished with their hedging program for this year. So she thinks a lot of this backwardation deepening was a result of a lot of different people all selling the back end of the curve. She thought Pemex had a big role to play in that. And I asked her, okay, does that mean that it's ending now? Should we expect that backwardation to come back out of the curve now that Pemex is done? Or are other guys hedging going to continue? And she said, I don't know. There's definitely other guys that are still hedging. The message to take away here is, everybody, as soon as they see the entire curve, including the long-dated months, moving above $50, they're hedging like crazy. So that's what's going on. Definitely, Pat is an excellent follow on Twitter if you're interested in these aspects of the oil market. Pat Hemsworth, just put P-H-E-M, that's Papa Hotel Echo Mike, into your Twitter search box. She'll be the first name on the list. Moving on, in the short term, there's definitely a strong uptrend, which frankly has caught me off guard. It may be over now, 52.88 on the November contract. Contract adjusted for December, that's about 53.20. That may be the top. We may still have another push higher to 54, maybe even 55. I'm not sure. But through the end of the year, my outlook is bearish. I think that stocks are being moved around, but I don't think they're getting used up. I think this rally is overdone, and I think that gravity is overdue to set in, at least in the intermediate term, let's say for the rest of this year. I want to be really clear, though, in acknowledging I could be wrong. Art is definitely right about the fact that U.S. stocks are going to continue to be drawn down, especially with this Brent WTI spread as wide as it is. Longer term, you know, what's the view? I think that there's a wildly, wildly bullish play in crude oil when shale has played out and it's time for the industry to say, okay, our next incremental source of oil, if we cannot continue to make more shale wells because we've used up all of the good plays, we're going back to deep water, and they say, oh, Transocean just scrapped a bunch of rigs this week. We're not ready to go back to deep water offshore production because we don't have the equipment to do it. It has to be built. We haven't been investing in that. Now we're in real trouble. There's a big upspike in prices coming in the next few years. I just don't know when. The really big important part of this story, what I think is most important, the really big story, though, in terms of an investment play, Patrick, if things continue to play out with backwardation continuing to develop, even as prices move down, which a lot of people are predicting they will, if we get to the point where we're at $45 Brent and the curve is still in backwardation, that means you're going to be able to buy those 2020 and 2021 futures contracts in the 30s. That is a bargain. By the time we get to 2021, the price of oil is going to be much higher than the 30s. So that's a big fat buy. I don't know if we're going to get there or if prices drift down, if we're going to move back into a contango structure, which I think is probably more likely.
Now, Eric, I wanted to just touch on this Aramco IPO. Now, I was just reading that Nick Cunningham article on oilprice.com where he was suggesting that this Aramco IPO is on the brink of collapse. And the idea was that they're considering this private sale to sovereign wealth funds. Now, I was reading as well Kevin Muir at the Macro Tourist, who speculated that Saudi Arabia leaked the story to get other buyers to bid up, which, if true, he suggests is a dangerous game to play. What's your take on this?
Well, of course, we've got both Nick's article as well as Kevin's article in the research roundup. You'll find the download links, and I definitely encourage people to read those. I think that the big picture here, the IPO is definitely at risk. Frankly, I've been skeptical that this IPO was really going to happen for a long time. But the news that's come out in the last week has really got me thinking about just all of the possible permutations of things that could happen, because it looks like what's going on here is Saudi Arabia is realizing that in order to do the IPO, they're going to have to be more transparent than they want to be, opening their books up, as Art Berman talked about. They don't want to do that. So they're looking for private placements to sovereign wealth funds. China has stepped up to the plate and said they're interested in buying up to 5% of Aramco and want to negotiate a deal. imagine, Patrick, the various things that could happen. Suppose, just as one example, that China were to sit down. Just imagine, Patrick, that behind closed doors right now, China and Saudi Arabia are meeting and talking about, look, you got a problem, we got a problem. Saudi Arabia, your problem is you need to show the market that you're exporting less in order to get prices gamed higher. But the problem is that if you lie about it and you're really shipping more than that and the tanker trackers guys are paying attention, they're going to catch you at it. They're going to call you out so you can't bluff. So let's make this deal. Give China a special discount. You sell oil to us for $40 a barrel and you sell your oil to the rest of the world at market prices. What we're going to do is we're going to buy it on layaway. We're going to let you, Saudi Arabia, store that oil for us. We'll send some Chinese military special forces over to guard it for us, make sure it's safe. Everybody knows it's ours. But we're going to keep it in Saudi Arabia so that the tanker trackers can't see that it's been sold. And we'll store it there for a few years. That'll give us time to build more SPR capacity in China. And when we get to a market condition where you're not so worried about having to manage what the market perception is, then at that point, we'll get a bunch of ships and we'll move the oil over to China. And maybe we'll start storing some more oil in Saudi Arabia. If they were to make that deal, it would allow Saudi Arabia to tell the world that they cut production by 2 million barrels a day and get away with it. And there's no way to tell inside of Saudi Arabia that they're really pedaling as fast as they can and still producing as much oil. Now, I just made that story up in my head. My point is not to predict that that exact scenario is happening. My point is just consider how many possible things could come out of private parties negotiating private placements confidentially to buy Aramco. If China, if sovereign wealth funds are negotiating privately with Saudi Arabia, anything is possible. And I just think it's important to think about all of the different possibilities that could arise from this.
Now, Eric, I wanted to move on and give a little bit of lip service to Robert Shiller, who wrote an article in New York Times suggesting a stock market panic like 1987 could happen again. Now, the acknowledgement in there is that such events involve the human psyche on a mass scale, and that essentially we're still vulnerable to that. You know, and inside the article, he discusses portfolio insurance back in 1987 and how it acted like stop losses, basically creating that liquidity event that drew the market down. And then it kind of made me reflect on Marco Kolonovic from JP Morgan, who on numerous occasions has compared all of the way that today money flows in terms of risk parity funds, the vol targeting funds, all of these the short volatility ETFs that exist, everything from passive investing to all the trend following algos out there, that these are all synthetic stop losses underneath the market. And today when we have all of this compressed realized volatility and the volatility is just shrinking in there, that it's almost like these stop losses are tightening up underneath. And at some point, I asked the question, could this become this market cycle's equivalent to 1987's portfolio insurance? What's your thinking?
Well, I think you're asking all the right questions. I don't really have authoritative answers for them. I guess what I would say is Martin Armstrong made a really good point on this program, which is normally what causes a real market crash to happen is retail investors panicking and selling at the exact wrong moment. Well, we don't have enough retail participation in the market to really cause that to happen. On the other hand, this ETF situation where if ETFs start unwinding and there's no liquidity and there's no natural buyers of the underlying issues that the market makers have to sell in order to keep the ETF in balance, you know, that could do it. High frequency trading pulling out of the market could do it. So I don't think it is exactly an equivalent to say, oh, this is just like portfolio insurance. I guess probably the adage here is, you know, history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. I don't think it's the same thing by any stretch as portfolio insurance in 87, but I think an event of that magnitude is absolutely possible. And it's, you know, one of the things that I've said many times before is a lot of people are saying, yeah, but, you know, when we get the 10% sell-off in the market, there's lots and lots of people. Institutions are telling their advisors left and right, as soon as we get that 10%, we're going to buy it like crazy. Well, if they get a 10% pullback over the course of a month, I believe that that's true. If they get a 10% pullback in the stock market over the course of half an hour, then I think that it is an outright panic and anything could happen. So what are the triggers that could allow that to happen? What can go wrong with high-frequency trading, which nobody really understands completely in terms of how deep its risks are? What could happen if people are starting to bail out of the market and ETFs are unable to find natural buyers for the underlying shares? You know, there's all kinds of things that can go wrong. I don't think anybody knows yet.
All right. Well, before we close, can you let our listeners know what to expect in terms of the increased programming through the year end, thanks to those generous donations we've been receiving?
Well, the original plan was that we were going to air the remainder of Eurodollar University, part three Thanksgiving, part four Christmas, and we weren't sure what we were going to do for the new year. Thanks to the generous donations that we've received, we can now budget more content creation. So we're going to accelerate this. We're going to release part three of Eurodollar University this weekend. So that should be out. We're not sure if it's going to be Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Sometime this weekend, we're going to get you part three. It will be a special episode that will just be the interview with Jeff Snyder. It's not going to have a market wrap and a post game and so forth. We're still juggling the schedule to figure out when we can get you part four, but it'll definitely be before Christmas. Then for the last 2 weeks of the year, we're working on a new project, and I'm not going to give it away quite yet because we haven't got final confirmation from the guests involved. But I'll just say this. If you liked Eurodollar University with Jeff Snyder, what we have in mind for the last couple weeks of the year is going to blow your mind. It's a special program and it's fantastic content. Cross your fingers that we're able to pull it off because it's not confirmed yet with the guests that we've invited, but we are going to commit to the accelerated release of Eurodollar University. So look for the third episode of Eurodollar University coming out this weekend. So finally, I want to again thank the donor who made the $1,000 donation this week that made this all possible. I'm not going to mention his name on the air because I don't have his permission to do so, but it has definitely allowed us to bring you more content, and we really appreciate it. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. Of course, we've already gone well beyond our usual budget time, but our listeners tell us to do that. So we're trying to bring you as much quality content as we possibly can. In order to do that, we need your help promoting the show, folks. The more that you can do to tell your friends about Macro Voices, forward your research roundup emails to your friends and colleagues. Donate if you're able to help us defray our production costs. But most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com, because the number of registered users we have, that statistic is the bargaining chip that Patrick uses to entice the very best guests to come on the program. So go to macrovoices.com. It only takes a few minutes to sign up. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email, which never contains advertising or marketing. We won't spam you. We won't sell your email address to anybody. All we'll do is send you a weekly email which contains a compendium of links to things like Art Berman's download from this week's show, as well as all of the free cool stuff that we could find on the internet every single week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
All right. Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Art. You'll also find the slide deck that Art and Eric discussed during the post game. Also, earlier when we mentioned the article from Nick Cunningham at oilprice.com talking about the Aramco IPO, you'll find that link in the research roundup as well. The Robert Shiller article in the New York Times talking about the fact that a panic like 1987 could happen again. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.